Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guests today, two guests, Amy and Steve Bresnan of Bresnan & Associates here in Austin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, we wanted to have you on. For those folks who don't know you, Amy and Steve are both lawyer lobbyists here in town. The appellate Twitter crowd, I think, will have seen their names because they're both very active on Twitter. And just because they're not appellate lawyers doesn't mean they can't participate in appellate Twitter, my goodness. But let's just kind of go through our usual routine on the show, which is have you kind of give a little short introduction of yourselves, tell us about yourselves, your background, education, and maybe some experience before you went to law school.
Well, I think I'm designated here for right now. I started out life in retailing when I was a very young person and got a hankering to do something that had a little more redeeming social value, and went and got an undergraduate degree in education and worked in the inner city in Dallas, ran some alternative schools over in East Texas. The school people got sick of me, and I got hired by a legal services outfit to do voting rights workshops in 43 counties in East Texas, because I had been a litigant in a voting rights case along with the president of the NAACP in Nacogdoches. And that led me to meet a guy named Paul Ragsdale, who was an African-American legislator from Dallas and had done that work a decade before me. And Paul and I hit it off, and Paul invited me to come to Austin and go to work for him. He introduced me to Bob Bullock along the way, and then Comptroller Bullock hired me to work over in his shop. And then I helped him with his opposition research when he ran for lieutenant governor. And that helped me make my way to the lieutenant governor's office, where I spent 5 years. Started lobbying in 96 for a variety of different kinds of clients. Amy?
Well, I grew up in Mount Vernon, Texas, which I think is important to note. I think that growing up in a small town has actually helped me in politics. I think that it's actually easier for people who come from small towns to learn big city talk than vice versa. And so that's paid off as far as relations in the legislature. My family was extremely political. I think three members of my family were mayor of Mount Vernon. And my grandfather was a state representative. And my aunt Vetra, who's no longer with us, worked for Lieutenant Governor Bill Ratliff from the start. So it was natural for me to go into politics, but I went to TCU. So go Frogs.
Go Frogs.
Hope the game is successful tomorrow. And then from TCU, I went to Texas State University. But during that time, I worked in the House for State Representative Jim Keffer from Eastland. And then after grad school, I worked for Senator Corona. When I worked for Senator Corona in 2011, I knew that I was going to go to law school. And so I went to law school in 2012. At St. Mary's. And so we were talking about this the other day. People asked me, why didn't you practice law? I think once you work in the legislature, it's very hard to leave the legislature and enter a totally different realm. And law school to me was, it was basically a third public policy degree. I knew that I would take it back and lobby, and it's paid off tremendously.
And Steve, did we hear your law school story? I think you mentioned lobbying, but I'm not sure we heard about.
Well, I did go to law school. Representative Ragsdale, when he asked me to come to work for him, I asked him if I could go to law school while I did. And he said, I put the last white guy that worked for me through law school, I'll put you through law school too. And he did. In addition to inducing me to Bob Bullock, Paul basically gave me a career. I'm greatly indebted to him. I miss him. He's passed away several years ago. But I went to UT Law after sitting out of undergraduate and graduate school for long periods of time. It's the consternation of my parents. I don't know why they were consternated. They weren't paying for it, but they were ready for me to get on and do something in life. Anyway, I ended up at UT Law, graduated from UT in 86, took the bar in 88. So I've been licensed since 88.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
So we have some sense of how each of you kind of got into lobbying. I mean, you went to law school after you were already doing lobbying work. Is that pretty common for lobbyists, or maybe it's all over the map? I don't know.
Well, I did not. I was working for a member of the House while I was in law school, and then I went to the controller's office and then the lieutenant governor's office. But I finished law school while I was working for a member of the House, took the bar in 88 while I was still working at the controller's office, and then got my license at that time. I didn't start lobbying until 96.
Sorry, I misspoke.
My problem.
To answer your question, I think it's more and more common. So clearly it's not required that you have a law degree to lobby, but I do think that it's helpful. If you look at the top 20, top 30, Mike Haley, he does a lobby ranking. It's not even that half of them in the top 10 are lawyers, but it helps your overall lobbying skill set to be able to read bills more precisely and, of course, write legislation. So we lobby for the family lawyers and TTLA and the court reporters. And so before I went to law school, I knew that I would say that a substantial amount of it would be in the work of the legal field. So as far as that's concerned, it's been extremely helpful.
I think part of what we sell is our ability to move around between various policy subject matters. We have a very large client on the top of the heap, AT&T, down to some guys who own bingo halls on the tiny side, and a wide variety, healthcare, water, lots of things in the middle. And I think having that legal background allows you to move between subject matters in the way appellate lawyers are always working between subject matters. So you would understand that. And I think it's helpful. We don't sell ourselves as the biggest entertainers, schmoozers, biggest political participants by way of contributions or because of party affiliation or anything. We market and I hope deliver a policy approach that is hopefully that'll always be needed in the legislature.
And just to add to that, it's not like when the legislative session is over that we're finished with our work. I would say the bulk of our work is actually done in the executive branch as far as agency rulemaking. And so just to have a basic fundamental understanding of the Administrative Procedures Act is extremely helpful when you're pivoting and going from the legislature to the executive branch.
I can imagine, you mentioned in terms of bill analysis and all that, that having that legal training would benefit you in ways you're not looking at the law or the bills the same way that a layperson would be. Layperson, I'm sure an experienced layperson lobbyist would get some understanding of how this process works over time, but you're starting off at a little different level. If you didn't practice law as a litigator, you at least went through the rigors of a legal education to understand how judges think about lots of different issues, a lot of common law and even statutory issues. It has to be an advantage, I would think.
Well, particularly on the statutory construction front. And also, I think every lawyer I know has, when the client comes in, the client thinks they know what their problem is and what they need. And time you get the whole story and you think of ways maybe to go about solving their problem or addressing their problem that are more in the client's interest. I think by way of our background, we frequently are confronted with people that want to parachute in and get the legislature or an executive branch agency to do something about their problem. And frequently it's not the problem, or their proposed solution is one that's not doable, unwise, whatever the diagnosis might be. So being able to move around between the subject matters and having that legal perspective, I think, is helpful towards service of the client in that regard.
Well, and I was going to ask y'all to kind of give us maybe a high level view, because I think you hear the word lobbyist and you get a lot of different images and kind of connotations to that. How would you explain to a layperson kind of what you do?
In 2010, I wrote a paper in grad school and used gambling as sort of a prism to describe what lobbyists do. And if I were just discussing it with a stranger at an airport, I would describe it first from an electoral standpoint as far as campaign work. And Steve and I do work on campaigns. But a lot of times what we do is it goes way beyond contributing. If we're asked or if we feel so moved, then we will assist with opposition research. And if you want to be a good opposition researcher, it's important to understand property law. For example, when you're researching property records, just having an overall grasp for where the banana peels might be with the potential candidate is very much helped by having that background. As far as grassroots lobbying, that ties more into the electoral part, building relationships, research. I think Steve and I are both read everything we can get our hands on. I think that's probably our way of understanding things. Everybody has a different approach to it, but I would say researching, building relationships, and work on campaigns would be how I would describe what lobbyists do. At least that's what we do. I mean, it's like Steve said, there are a lot of lobbyists who entertain a lot more, and there are lobbyists who are much more active on campaigns at all levels than we are. I guess that would be it.
A lot of it is not very sexy and may not even be that influential, but a certain amount of it is what I refer to as shoe leather lobbying. And in effect, it's door-to-door sales. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to go into the Capitol building and go into an office cold. They may have no interest currently in what you've got to tell them, and then break something down to people who may have no understanding whatsoever the subject matter that you're talking about. So being able to translate and to do it promptly, many messages are conveyed walking through the hall of the Capitol building with a member of the legislature or a staff member, where you've got 30 seconds to a minute, minute and a half to convey what it is you're interested is and what your ask is. If you follow Jerry Bullard's reports on the legislature, he does a fantastic job of breaking down and explaining, and you can get a sense from his reports of the volume that you're dealing with. So there may be in excess of 8,000 bills filed between the houses. You have to be cognizant of every one of them. A lot of things that you're working on can be amended into a bill that you don't have any idea, had no expectation that that bill is going to be a vehicle to do something. So watching all the bills as they're filed, reading them all, dispersing them to people like clients who can look, tell you, does this affect you or not? Then tracking them through the legislative process, looking for amendments, attending committee hearings, monitoring, communicating to clients and others about what transpired at that committee hearing, all of those sorts of things go into it. It's a much more nuts and bolts type of a job than most people usually think of. The term lobbyist comes from, there's an area outside of each chamber of the legislature. It's the lobby. People who stand around in the lobby are lobbyists. And the only thing you have to do to be a lobbyist, really, I mean, other than a citizen lobbyist, is to have a client. So there's no particular training, background, license, any of that required. We do have to file ethics reports and things like that, but that's just a matter of registration. So if you're doing it right, you either yourself or you have the capability of support staff to be doing all those nuts and bolts functions that are really central to why the thing works. And my experience has been, and I think Amy's found this out as well, being on the field is probably about 85 to 90% of the game. I personally believe that familiarity breeds consent. And so we try to be familiar because we're in the Capitol, in offices, talking to staff, talking to members.
And just to add to that, it's the legislature probably needs a high level of supervision. And so even if you show up to a committee hearing, to let those legislators know that you're paying attention and that if they're working, you're working, that's really the main message that you want to convey to legislators. They have been here since January. There's going to be a fourth called special session. They're exhausted. Mm-hmm. We're exhausted.
I'm sure.
And so for you to just show up at the committee hearing and say, and to basically convey like, hey, we're all in this together. And by the way, don't hurt our clients. I think it goes a long way. We're not the type of lobbyists who phone it in. And for those who can do that, more power to them. But that's not really how we operate.
And literally phone it in, like they're not hanging out down in the committee hearings and so forth like you are. Exactly. They're calling the legislators' offices.
Right. Or texting a member, that sort of thing. Not that we don't text members if we're lucky enough to have their phone numbers, but there's just a certain amount of being there that they appreciate that you're invested personally in the process. We don't really have anything. Well, we got a little project to work on next week, but for the most part, during these special sessions, we haven't had anything really biting us. But if we show up down there and wave at them, they'll inevitably they'll say, hey man, why are you around here? You're here. We thought we'd drop in and say hello. So people appreciate it. It's a people business and all the ways in which you can think that the people appreciate other people in a very normal social interaction, nothing fancy or extravagant or nefarious.
Well, in some ways, it doesn't sound all that different than lawyering because you're still trying to persuade. I think lawyering in many ways is a people business, whether it be relationships with the decision maker or relationships with the client, which I would imagine there's some similarities in your client relationships too, with respect to how those work versus an attorney-client relationship. How do you go about getting clients?
Usually through word of mouth, which I think in that regard, it's very similar to a traditional practice of law. It's usually word of mouth. There have been times where we've garnered clients through an interview process where three lobby teams will be up and then the potential client chooses between those lobby teams. But I would say 70% of it is word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
And you know, back to what you're talking about, how it's a lot like the practice of law. You know, if you go into the courthouse and you go to the clerk's office, if you know that clerk that's out there that's going to take your documents and get them stamped and filed, although I guess that's being done electronically now, I'm dating myself. But those kind of things, knowing the court coordinator and attending to his or her needs, which is critical. And we value very much staff. We were both staff. We understand the importance and the honorable nature of staff work. Mm-hmm. And so we pay lots of attention to that aspect of it.
And I would say the longer that I've lobbied, the more I realize this works for and against you. But unlike a court of law, everything at the legislature is admissible. You know, whether it's character evidence, hearsay. Yeah.
Well said.
In some ways that makes it easier, but it also makes it harder because if there's a witness testifying who is opposite of your view and they quote something that is just wrong from some amicus brief, then you're on the spit to go and immediately correct it because it's already in the record, right? The so-called record. And so that cuts both ways.
One of the things we do that's nuts and bolts is create our own exhibits. We do bullet points, talking points for witnesses. We testify. We make charts and graphs and all the sorts of things that you would try to admit into a lawsuit, lots of letter writing and that sort of thing. And so there are some definitely some commonalities, but like Amy says, people who lie will be gone in a week. You cannot get away for very long.
Unless they contribute substantial amounts of money in some cases. It's Friday afternoon. I'm a little cynical and honest. Sorry. But
well, it's been my experience that, you know, lying's frowned on. You might get away with it in the short term, but you will not.
And that's true.
In the long run.
Obviously, you all do consume just mountains of information during the regular session. And then you're trying to see and be seen and shake hands and meet with legislators and advocate for your clients in the ways that lobbyists do. Do you really do it, the two of you, or do you have folks that help you out with some of the logistical aspects of it, like preparing the bullet points and things like that?
Well, in 2021, and this is true of all lobby groups, we suspended. For example, we represent the Texas Family Law Foundation, and we usually have two family lawyers come in each week during the legislative session because we're working on defense and we're also trying to pass legislation at the same time. So we normally have helpers each week to be mostly working on defense while we're trying to pass the foundation's agenda. We also usually have an assistant who does administrative work, makes appointments, gets lunches. We didn't have an assistant in 2021. So I guess to answer your question, we normally do have some type of assistance, whether it's just administrative or working on substantive law and talking points.
Also, it kind of depends on the client too. You've got some clients that have a whole shop that's designed to crank out talking points, provide the information that you need and dispense it. And you're usually a part of a team there. Some clients are very well suited to crank out amendments for something that needs amended.
And those are lawyer associations who are in the best position to do that.
And major corporations that have ongoing government affairs business.
You mentioned the family lawyers, Amy. That's a group that you work with regularly. They basically sign up for a certain period of time, I guess, and they're coming down to be your support for when you're lobbying on their behalf. Is that accurate?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So the advanced family law course is every August in San Antonio. And during even numbered years, 4 to 5 months before the legislative session, there's an opportunity. You have to be a member of the Texas Family Law Foundation. There's an opportunity for you to sign up to be a bill reviewer or a volunteer, which means you would physically come down to Austin and go door to door. So those opportunities are available and it's important. So you're representing your entire law practice. So
we'll hold a legislative boot camp for them, usually November, maybe early December before the session starts in an odd-numbered year, and give them practice at being witnesses. Just take them into a committee room, have a mock legislative committee hearing.
Yes, because every session, especially with the new volunteers, at some point during a committee hearing, they will call the chairperson of the committee, Your Honor. Oh. And everybody cracks. I mean, it's fine. Everybody cracks up. They get it.
There's me. Man.
Yeah, it takes some getting used to.
Yeah.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Well, about the Family Law Foundation, I don't want to go too far down this road, but it's worth mentioning, I think, that there's a reason why it's not like the Family Law Association who is working with you all directly. It's the Family Law Foundation. And that's because the Bar Association groups themselves are very restricted in what they can do in terms of lobbying efforts, right?
Yes.
But I also know, just from having observed, that that Family Law Foundation and that advanced course that you mentioned, they're super highly attended, and there's a very strong presence within that organization because those folks have, I guess, a certain interest in what's going on in the legislature, which I imagine is every session, there's something related to family law.
Hundreds of bills every session.
Yeah. And so there were more family law bills filed in 2021 during a pandemic and a freeze than in 2019. And that, I need to check the statistics on that, but it might be that 2021 was a record-setting family law bill filing session. I need to go back and look at 2017. 2017 was pretty rough too.
So our bill review committee is managed by a guy named Chris Rampelmeyer out of Amarillo. And Amy, and sometimes, but mostly Amy, will go through and screen all the bills as they're filed and send the appropriate ones to Mr. Rampelmeyer, who has 50 or 60 people who have signed up. We use a cloud-based app, and they will review the bill and analyze it and break it down into everyday language that Amy and I can then use to go, and our volunteers, when they show up, can use to go take a position. Do we amend this bill? Do we oppose this bill? Do we care? Do we not care? Do we support the bill? And so the family lawyers are very well organized in that regard and have been very effective, but they have to be because there's a lot of their business. You know, they say if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so being deployed is a hugely important thing. And that's true for everybody that's going to have the legislature mucking around in their business.
And so on this cloud-based app, which we'll go and name, a lot of times that there will be a very passionate discussions about what position to take on a bill and what the issues are. Going back to how does having a law degree help you lobby? This would be an example of having a legal education helps you to know what questions to ask. So when you enter the discussion, you're not just coming at it from a lobby standpoint, but you're coming, like you're trying to understand more in-depthly from a practitioner standpoint what the issue is. And so having that background is important to know what questions to ask the client in that situation.
How does the advocacy differ? Because it can be adversarial, but generally it's not necessarily adversarial at the start. It's, your role kind of sounds almost more like an amicus where you're sort of bringing in unique interest that has a perspective that can maybe shape the way that these things develop.
It depends on who your opponent or adversary is. I mean, for example, so there are a lot of, there have been in the past a lot of ad hominem attacks, a lot of character attacks with regard to this issue known as 50-50. And so it's mostly fathers who have either been wronged by the court system or in a lot of cases think that if they get 50-50, they don't have to pay child support. And sometimes they can get ugly. In 2017, they issued a death threat on Facebook. So that's a little personal. And so you do go on the offensive when your life is threatened and you attack back. But for the most part, it's a tense, it's an intense atmosphere, but it's not necessarily adversarial. It's not hostile. I guess that's a better way to put it.
One thing to understand about the legislative process is it's a lot harder to pass a bill than it is to kill a bill. Lots of places in the process where a bill can find its resting place. And there's only one way that you're going to get across the finish line. And that's something that's at least some vehicle that passed both houses, the same language in it, and made its way to the governor. So some of it is more adversarial than others. We have people in the process who we have routinely been against over the years or sparred with, who we've actually become very good friends with. Even though things started out a little tense at the beginning, those things tend to get worked out over time, at least at the personal level, much the way lawyers do. You see the same people around cases, and even when they're not being their best selves, usually come back to it.
Yeah.
So we do too. The advocacy is a little bit different partly because there are so many places for the thing to go into the tank. And that's great if you're trying to kill bills. If there's 400 or 500 family law bills filed, there's going to be a fair chunk of them that we're going to work hard to make sure don't become law. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of them can be fixed. Nobody's an expert in everything. Mm-hmm. So you may have somebody who's built a big business and they know their business. I'll just talk about a friend of ours who deals with the valves, brass and steel valves, and for use in plumbing and industrial processes and all that. Well, that guy knows that business inside and out, and we don't. So bridging that gap is maybe a little bit different. You all know you show up in a courtroom, and particularly at the appellate level, you got 9 people sitting up there who may or may not know anything about steel valves and what's a manufacturing defect and what's not, and you got to explain it to them. That's very similar, I think, to legislative process, at least getting the context and some rudimentary understanding across.
The idea of being actively engaged in trying to kill a bill is fascinating to me. We just don't see that part of it. And as lay people, or whether you're a lawyer or layperson or whatever, we read Jerry's reports and we see kind of what's going on, and we know that the committee hearings are happening, but we're not seeing that sort of, what I guess you might say, behind the scenes kind of things going on that I would imagine you would do to try and kill a bill. That just creates this image in my mind that I think is just really interesting. And yeah, talk about a different kind of advocacy.
It's like the Sherlock Holmes story about the dog that didn't bark. You don't hear it. You don't see it. And yet there was something happening. And out of 8,000 bills getting filed, maybe 1,500 of them become law. So legislators file things all the time that they have no intention of pushing. Some of them die because of rabid advocacy. So there's lots of different reasons for things to die. But the hardest thing to convey to clients is what didn't happen to them.
Yeah.
It's a central deal about what lobbyists do, is to try to make sure bad things don't happen. If something bad's like going to happen, to try to take the sharp point off of it.
That sounds familiar, actually.
Yes. If you look at a bill, so let's just take the anti-slap statute reform bill of 2019. We've made so many friends on appellate Twitter because of that bill, because of the anti-slap statute reform. We've had friends email us and reach out and say, what's up with this provision? Why is this in there? And we will be completely honest with them. Mm-hmm. In the law review article that we wrote.
I was going to say, you wrote an article about it.
Well, it was a labor of love. And actually, it was great timing because we were in the last stages of editing during the beginning of the pandemic. You can't leave your home. You might as well write a law review article, right?
Sure. Why not?
So we do try to convey in that law review article, this is what was happening behind the scenes. This is why this is, so-and-so asked for this exemption. So-and-so asked for this other exemption. And just give a little bit of legislative history.
Yo, this is an opportune time for me to get some information from y'all.
Sure.
All right.
Before the anti-slap statute, the reform, we were very much aware that Chapter 27 was gobbling up the world of litigation out there. Do you sense that anymore? If not neutered, did we make appropriate use of that statute instead of the way it was? Or what do you think?
I think really Todd's partner is the best person to answer this, Amanda Taylor. But I think just anecdotally.
I love Amanda Taylor. She would be one of the ones I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I have seen less of it, and I have seen it not shoved in places where it didn't seem like it fit and you had to fight against that. I mean, you kind of talk about killing a bill. So much of my involvement with the anti-slap stuff was trying to kill it from being applied in cases where it just didn't make sense, but there wasn't a clear answer.
Yep.
And I just don't see that as much.
I agree with that. I have not seen it as frequently and not heard about it as frequently and not seen it in as many court opinions that just seem like they were, I mean, you apply the literal language of the former version of the statute and it was just so all encompassing of everything. And yeah, it was the classic tail wagging the dog situation that, I mean, there are other areas of that statute that some would say could be curbed some more. But I think in terms of the areas where there was a difference made is some of the definitions dealing with some of the scope of the statute. I think it has made a difference.
That's good to hear. So many times when we work on things, they get the governor's signature and they go off into the universe. If we make a change in the law, one of our clients sells off wrecked cars for insurance companies, and that involves a lot of motor vehicle titling work and things. So we go work on stuff, how they get the information to find the owner and get the title and do all that stuff. You get all that in the statute, it goes off, but we don't ever hear because we're not in the business. We're not on site with them. This particular one, though, because of our representation of the trial lawyers and the family lawyers.
And AT&T.
Well, and AT&T, interesting story. If anybody's listening to the podcast, you hadn't seen the Law Review article, it's available from St. Mary's University, free of charge. You can download an electronic version. I think there's been over 4,000 downloads now. And you'll see AT&T as a company had a very keen interest in being able to enforce non-compete agreements, for example, or non-disclosure agreements. On the other hand, in the middle of the session in 2019, their merger with Warner Media was approved by the courts and the antitrust department. And all of a sudden, they became a media company overnight. So the protection of the media's interests as speakers and conveyors of speech, they wanted to make sure that that protection, which really was what the original SLAPP statute was about. And so in that case, because we're very close to the company and have lots of involvement with them, we can see a little bit about how things have been playing out.
Mm-hmm. That's another example of where while y'all are out writing briefs or you're in the courtroom, you know, we're at the Capitol, we're seeing bills. I remember in 2011 when the original anti-SLAPP statute legislation was filed, and I wasn't even in law school yet. And I remember looking at it and thinking, this is very broad, and asking one of my colleagues about it. And they're like, oh, it's for the media. And I'm like, but it doesn't read like it's for the media. We are literally at the ground zero of where potentially harmful legislation, or at least influential legislation regarding the practice of law. I mean, we're there. We're at the front.
Oh, yeah.
There was a bill filed this past session that is original as far as its standing provision, any person, anywhere. And when it was filed, I was like, Steve, you might want to look at this. This is not just another abortion bill. And as you can see, like, I'm not advocating for restricting or expanding standing in Texas, but just know that this is huge. And it's fascinating.
Its forerunner was a bill in the 2019 session that dealt with discrimination against people for their participation in a support of a religious entity. That is a case now that will be argued on the 28th of October, that standing is a key issue in it and may very well tell us what the court would do on standing in the Senate Bill 8, the abortion bill. That one's called Von Dolan versus City of Von Dolan et al. Versus City of San Antonio. If your listeners are not up to speed on it, they should rapidly get up to speed on it because it's monumental importance.
I can't imagine if you're in appellate law that standing is not something that you wake up thinking about and go to bed thinking about. I just can't imagine.
Todd, I can tell from your face there's something you want to say about this.
Well, no, I was just going to say that's what they affectionately call the Chick-fil-A bill.
Right.
Right. These guys, Von Dolan and his chums, their attorney claims that you don't have to have any kind of injury for the legislature to confer standing. But if they're required to have one, then they're people who use the San Antonio airport and would eat a Chick-fil-A sandwich at the airport if it were there. That's their injury. I kid you not. I'm not making this up.
Name a better chicken sandwich. I dare you.
I think we're digressing a little, but
amazing moment. The point we're trying to make is sometimes we see these things coming through the legislative process and we can see this is important. It's going to play out over a period of time and reverberate.
Oh, yeah. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Well, we'll drop a link to the article because I did notice when y'all had released that and we're talking about it. And I thought, well, this is pretty cool. So we'll make sure that we can help make it available to other people who want to give it a look.
It starts with a Hamilton quote too. So you got to love that.
It does.
We went to go see Hamilton when we finished writing it. That was right before the apocalypse. So it has special meaning.
That's where I learned that Amy is a nut about sight form too. There's over 400 footnotes and she worked through those microscopically and made me shut up and get out of the way while she picked
that. That's that St. Mary's Law education, I'll tell you. I'm here to vouch for that. Well, I have to ask y'all, we're not at the time we have allotted fully yet, but we do need to be cognizant of time. And I don't want to let any more time go by without asking how y'all wound up as a married couple lobbying together in the same firm.
Well, to be consistent with my prior answers on this, Your Honor, I won her in a raffle.
That's cute, Steve. No, honestly, it involved a quart of Corona and a golf cart and the country of Mexico. But to give you a longer...
Sounds like a Jimmy Buffett song.
So I knew Steve from a distance because I was a staffer and I knew he was competent, but he was just another pushy, older lobbyist. We went to a birthday party separately for a mutual friend who works for Senator Whitmire. And that's where I saw him in another light. Like, he was no longer that just older, pushy lobbyist. And I liked him. I mean, we're married, but we're also best friends and clearly work together as well. So I actually didn't think that we would ever end up working together. But as I said in the other podcast, during law school, I realized that there's no way that we could live out the lives together that we intended to, which involves a lot of travel. I mean, we all know you can't walk into a law firm and say that you would like to take a month off. You know how that's going to go. So it worked out to where we can work together. It's working well. Frankly, I think that the age difference is very helpful with that. I think if we were the same age, I would probably be less deferential. Not that Steve requires deference, but at the end of the day, he does in fact have more experience than I do. And just now able to keep up with him on policy, and I attribute that to St. Mary's Law School. But he does have 28 years on me. So at the end of the day, I will listen to his point of view, but I may or may not agree.
Well, good thing we're not under oath.
No.
All I can say. One thing I've realized that as Amy has gained in experience, you can really see the St. Mary's training coming out, her master's in public administration coming out, and teaching an old dog that you don't have to do things the same way all the time, that there are other ways to do it. And all of that, that's been very rewarding, but sometimes I have to be made to shut up.
What is your schedule in life like during the session or endless sessions as we're having in 2021?
During session, first of all, I love it. I think Steve does too. We both love being busy. It's around the clock. And that's true for the weekends as well. In January and February, typically you work 8 to 9 hours a day, but starting in March when committee hearings are being held, you should just bank on having to work 18-hour days. I'm not saying that you're going to work 18 hours a day, but you need a plan to do it. And we both lose weight during session. We're running on fumes and passion a lot of times, which is why there's always one big fight during each session. And it's
between the two of you?
Oh, yeah, but it's great. It's great. And then we'll book a trip together and it's all fine. Here's what I didn't know about lobbying, even when I was a staffer. I didn't realize how physical lobbying is. I've literally chased a legislator before. Like, I've had to run after this person and we've laughed about it. But there's a lot of walking, a lot of standing on marble floors for hours on end. But during the interim, which we have not had this go around, but during the interim, it's you do get a lot of time off. But I would say during the legislative session, I guarantee you that we work just as hard, if not harder, than appellate lawyers. However, during the interim, that is absolutely not true, which I'll
you deserve it.
Yeah. Well, I'll text my friends who are practicing law and I'm like, hey, you want to meet at 4? And they're like, no, I can't meet you at 4. So I get it. It's seasonal. It's usually seasonal.
It's like a 140-day trial, right?
Right. I mean, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
You ramp up a little bit before it. You mm-hmm. still got to be deployed until the veto period's over and 20 days after session. Mm-hmm. But that 140 days right there, it owns you during that time period.
Oh, gosh. I can only imagine. Well, what about non-session years? I know you got a lot of time off after session ends in ordinary times. I know we've been in multiple special sessions now with more even expected. But how do you spend your time in non-session years?
Lobbying the client. And we do that during session, but what I mean is that's when we're getting the legislative agenda and the legislation. Some of the clients write the legislation themselves. They typically are lawyer clients, write it themselves. If non-lawyers, we're sitting down and writing it, and then we'll have someone submit it to legislative council. We're also attending fundraisers out of town. There's a lot of attention paid to clients during the interim because during session, that tends to be more directed at the legislature and the legislators.
And much of with the administrative state playing such a big role in modern life, many times after a session, we're working with state agencies to get rules promulgated that are taking account of what we think the statute says. And sometimes that's not exactly agreed upon about what the agencies think. Also, we have much more control of our time. Basically, every odd-numbered year, we try to carve out a month and go somewhere and really get to know the area. We went to the Balkans in the late summer and spent 30 days in Montenegro, the Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Croatia.
Right. So we did get away with that. And the reason why we got away with that is because the Democrats broke quorum. When that was announced, Steve and I literally opened a bottle of champagne, toasted, gave some legislators a hard time via text.
We couldn't take credit for it.
And got on a plane.
And our Republican friends who were still here waiting still seemed to like Amy's pictures on Instagram and Facebook. And
they were so
we paid no price for
it
yet. But we do like to travel, so we try to carve out the time to do that.
Well, it makes sense what Amy was saying about if you want to put it in the same category of law practice or any other profession, you really would have a very difficult time taking those sorts of stretches of time. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are too many lawyers out there who actually do have 140-day trials. But if they did, they would certainly deserve to take time off the way that you all do.
Yeah, no doubt.
Absolutely.
Because that's a schedule that'll just break you, I would imagine, if you're not careful. And it's great that y'all get to get away and spend time together and relax after such a period of very hard work.
We have no plants, no kids, no pets.
No plants.
Literally, if
unattached.
If we empty the refrigerator of everything that'll go bad, then we could leave for as long as we could get away with. So
we've talked about getting a succulent, though. I mean, it's in discussion.
She killed the bamboo, so we're maybe thinking maybe a cactus or something. You know,
that's pretty impressive because bamboo likes to grow.
Yes, I was impressed.
Before we wrap up, are there any accomplishments? Because I know there's a lot of different ways to measure accomplishments as a lobbyist. Are there any accomplishments or things that you're proud of that you want to share?
I would say the most enjoyable, so far, biggest accomplishment together has been the anti-SLAPP statute reform. I honestly, there were Fridays where I would just lock the bathroom door and start crying. I did not think that we were going to be able to pass it. It took so much work. And Steve told me, because I always thought killing bills felt great, right? It is nothing compared to passing a bill that you're passionate about. So I would say that has been my most rewarding experience at the legislature. What do you think?
Well, I think it's not really a lobby job, but one of the reasons that I'm proud of it is because it's not a lobby job. But we took on some very bad actors who were contaminating the political process and lying, cheating, stealing, and doing things politically that were harmful to the institution. We both pride ourselves in these institutions, House and the Senate in particular. And what I thought at the time could be considerable risk to us, we rendered them insignificant, and a separate entity ran them out of the state and completely out of business after the guy had to take the fifth 85 times at a deposition. Members of the legislature, I won't go into any further detail unless you guys question me about it, but
we won't.
Oh, maybe we should.
We stood up for the institution, and it worked. Where we thought we were at risk, legislators applauded it and still applaud it, even though we sort of pulled back. After a while, we thought, well, somebody else take on this good job, and people did. So I'm very pleased that we've been able to be ourselves a little bit and defend the institutions, even though it's out of the box for what lobbyists normally do. We were able to be Texans and defend the institutions that we work in and care about. So I'm very proud of those things.
That's great. Well, we always kind of traditionally end with a tip or a war story. I don't know if y'all have ones that you want to share or anything.
If y'all don't know Sinfronia Thompson, all you people on this podcast ought to do a little research about Sinfronia Thompson. You should have her on. Ms. Thompson's African-American legislator, first elected in 72, I believe. She's certainly the longest serving woman ever in the legislature. And if Speaker Craddock ever decides to hang it up, she'll be the largest serving person ever in the legislature. And Ms. Thompson was trying to pass the hate crimes bill. I think Governor Perry was governor, and there were seven Anglo legislators whose votes she wanted. And I was a fairly newly minted lobbyist, and Ms. Thompson called me to her office. We'd been friends since I showed up around the legislature in 81. She called me to her office, and she said, I need you to do something for me. You don't really tell Ms. Thompson no. And Ms. Thompson said, I got seven white guys. I need you to go get their votes for this hate crimes bill. And I'm sure I was not the only one with that assignment, because she's notorious for giving multiple people the same assignment. But working with other unknown or unnamed individuals, when that bill came up on the House floor, every one of those people walked down to the lectern, the podium at the front, and announced that it might cost them their House seats, but they were going to do the right thing, vote for that hate crimes bill. Very moving time, very important to the state and to Ms. Thompson, and I think to those people who honored the institution and did the right thing. So that's a war story. It's a non-Bob Bullock war story, too. Most people want me to tell Bullock war stories.
Oh, I bet there are a few of those. We'll have to have another podcast episode for that.
Statute of limitations is run on all of them. So we can do as needed.
What about you, Amy?
So I'm not going to go into detail, but it involves family law and a lot of coordination with a certain Senate staffer, and he knows who he is, and one day we will live to tell it. But anyway, we basically put some issues to bed that have been a burden for the legislature for a while. And it was done in a very sophisticated and honest way at the same time. But anyway, I'm not going to go into detail. So
we achieved a righteous result because of Amy's efforts. It's just that the people who are the beneficiaries of it have not yet realized that they're the beneficiaries of it. So one of these days, maybe they'll wake up.
Plus, primary season is around the corner, and so I'm going to refrain from going into detail.
Say no more. Yep. Well, thank you so much, really, to both of you for being with us. I knew when we approached y'all about coming on that we would learn a lot, because this is not an area that we know much about, and it doesn't necessarily come naturally to us, because as y'all know, we're all about talking to the judges about the law and not about working the lobbies and all the kinds of things that y'all do over at the building not too far away from my office. So it's been very enlightening. We're sure grateful to y'all for spending the time with us today.
We were pleased to be with you.
Yeah, happy to do it.
And hello to all our appellate friends out there. And Jerry, if you're listening, we plugged you, man.
We'll make sure Jerry. We'll make sure Jerry gets wind of this. That's great.
Thank you. I really appreciate
you. Bye all. Happy ACL Festival.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.